Welcome back to Campbell Conversations with your host, Colin Campbell. And today is episode 228 of the podcast. And I'm joined in conversation by Michael Bergson. Michael is the owner of Bucks Bar and Thundercat Pub and Diner. Michael has been at the forefront of speaking up for Scottish business and the hospitality sector in particular for the last 4 years in a significantly challenging backdrop, and he's been a real voice of reason and common sense during this period. In today's episode, you can expect to learn about Michael's entrepreneurial journey, the mentors and guidance which helped shape his business and his mindset, the importance of understanding your why and the long-term goal for your career and business that enables you to really do the work when it counts. Alongside this, Michael shares some of the secrets and hacks that he's done to improve the publicity and maximize the growth of Bucks Bar. Beyond this, I truly, really valued Michael's perspectives on the draconian C19 measures that we experienced in the last few years and the challenging and restrictive political environment for Scottish businesses with both rising taxes and an anti-growth narrative, an environment that's combined with policies like the deposit return scheme, the low emission zone, and of course the different things that we experienced during lockdown. Michael has stood up to be counted during this period, and I know many of you will appreciate this stance like I do and want to add weight to the sensible pro-growth voices which are challenging the current narrative in Scotland. If you are enjoying this episode, please take the time to share it to your LinkedIn or to your Instagram, or send it direct to a friend or colleague who would enjoy the conversation too. The silent majority really are waking up, and it's time to really push things forward in a positive aspect. If you're new here, make sure you've hit that subscribe button, and if you're listening on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify, take the time to leave a 5-star rating for the show. We've just smashed through 400 5-star ratings on Spotify, which is no mean feat, and the show continues to chart in the top 1% in the world, which is amazing for a show coming out of the west of Scotland. But that's quite enough for me in this introduction. You've got almost an hour and a half with myself and Michael after the music plays. Michael, welcome to the show. Managed to make this one happen in person, which I'm delighted about.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And I was thinking about where to start with this one, and nowadays you're known as a really forthright voice in Scottish hospitality, Scottish business. You've obviously got your established business in Bucks Bar, but I want to go back way before that and understand what the entry point was to the hospitality world.
My dad's local pub.
Okay.
That was it, the old Ship Bank in the Salt Market, and that was literally, I fancied working in a pub and I needed a job. And my dad had the hairdressers next door, barbers and hairdressers, and put a word in with me, and I got that. And from that point, he taught me the basics. Customer service, really valuable lessons. People ask me what was a lesson in that place, and Ship Bank was a fascinating place because you had the High Court building, and you also had Paddy's Market. So you would have lawyers coming in, and then you would have the guys coming in. You also had a hostel, and you had, you know, people in council houses. So it was this kind of real
eclectic mix.
And, you know, Glasgow Green's right across the road. So if something's on at Glasgow Green, you would get, you know, lots of people in. But, you know, for instance, I remember one time I was at the bar and I was getting into that way of talking to customers and knowing their orders and that kind of thing. And a wee old man came in, and he was possibly homeless, and he was quite dirty, and I gave him a half pint and a whiskey, wasn't drunk or anything like that, and he went to shake my hand, and I said, no, you're all right, you know, because his hands were dirty. And the owner, Frank, pulled me aside and he went, never ever knock back an outstretched hand. That is dreadful manners. That guy's spending his money the same as anyone else. Of course, that was a big valuable lesson, you know, and that's, to this day, I take that with me to the staff, you know. Don't care if it's someone coming in for a coffee or someone booking a big, huge party and spending fortunes. Treat them the same. You never know where it'll go. You don't care if they're complaining, if they're a difficult customer, give them the same respect, the same customer service, and you never know when they'll be back or how often they'll be back, you know.
There's a lot to be said for those values, isn't there? Like doing things massively, just the right way.
Yeah, doing things the right way. And, you know, I'll always say, you know, I can tell you, Kath Mitchell, a customer of mine, the first time I ever met her, she was complaining vehemently about anything, what would be described as, I think they called them Karens. You know, that's become, you know, these women that complain. But you handle it the right way. She ended up having her wedding in one of my venues, you know, so it's, you never know where it's going to lead. And that was the basis of customer service. And from then, I decided I wanted a career in hospitality. And then I went to work for the DiMaggio's group as a bar charge hand, worked my way up there. And then I kind of ended up running, becoming a bit of a specialist, running kind of bar, restaurant, nightclubs. There was a big craze for that in the kind of early 2000s. The Corinthian opened, Arta opened, Tiger Tiger. And I ended up running those three places.
I remember seeing that on your LinkedIn, Tiger Tiger stood out, because obviously that's a UK-wide company rather than just Scottish.
Yeah, so that was a good learning experience, because I'd gone from working for independent restaurant groups and entrepreneurs and answerable to the guy that owned it, to being part of a big PLC that was answerable to shareholders. So I got to see the different sides of the business in that sense.
Some more bureaucracy there potentially.
A lot. And actually, that's what kind of made me want to work, do my own thing, because I had all these bosses that I respected, my area manager, my marketing director. And I remember there was a private equity buyout. And I can remember the meeting where we were all called in, and my area manager, marketing director, all these guys, don't worry, your jobs are all safe. Everything's going to be fine. Nothing's going to change too much. A week later, they were all sacked. So I thought to myself, no, I think it'd be best to work for myself.
Those were the roles that you were probably aspiring to in terms of the career ladder as well.
Well, that was it. At that point in my career, I thought, that's what I'll aspire to. And then I can maybe get a directorship with a pub group. And I had my sights set on that, my heart set on that. And I thought, that's quite discouraging when you see these guys that are given, you know, over a decade of their career to this company. Both those guys are doing well now, but... you know, that made me think, I just want to work for myself.
What was your first venture then?
Soho and Miller Street in 2008. If anyone knows Glasgow, Miller Street was kind of, I was the only bar there at the time. Now it's got quite a few good places on it, including one giant pizzeria called Paisano, which has really brought Neapolitan pizza to Glasgow, probably the busiest restaurant in Glasgow. But I actually got my first site, which was downstairs, next door to where that site normally is. And I opened it in 2008 with the very last brewer's loan from Scottish and Newcastle before they got bought by Heineken. And the reason the brewer's loan,
for layman's terms, yeah.
Is when, what would happen was beer companies like Heineken or Scottish and Newcastle in this case, or tenants, for instance, used to do quite a lot of them, they'll say to you, right, we'll help finance your pub. We'll give you the same rate as, you know, interest rate as what the banks are giving you at the moment. But you have to buy your beer off of us, which, of course, you end up buying at an inflated price. So they've got you locked in. And that's how I got, you know, money for my first business. But I was the last one to go through because the credit crunch hit in 2008.
Of course.
So that deal nearly fell through. I nearly didn't have a business. And they got bought out by Heineken not long after that. And that was my first place. And I really struggled for about 3 years. It was really, really tough.
Consumer spending would have been lower at that point as well, because that was a real credit crunch, wasn't it? We really felt
it
that.
We had to do an express lunch for two courses for £4.75. And you're doing 200-300 covers of that some days, with trying to do it with three staff to make it work too in the kitchen. So we had very simple menus like that. And we did two courses of a cocktail for £12 at weekends, and everyone was booking that. But even at that, sometimes we had to fill the place. We had to do that through booking websites like 5pm.
And you're paying them a kicker commission. As well.
So, and then you're buying your beer at an inflated price, and then, of course, your volumes and it aren't that high. So it was tough. It was tough. So I had to go back to work for a while.
I've heard you say this before. What was that then?
So I was lucky, actually, to be honest. I can remember at one point, this first place was taking 12 grand a week. We were £120,000 in debt. You don't have to be a genius to work out that's not sustainable and going up, this debt. When I say that, it was to HMRC. It was to, most of it was to PAYE. We've got the VAT man turning up at our door. Actually, it was a VAT girl, Julie, first name terms with her. You know, she used to come to the door. Oh, are you all right there, Michael? How's the dog? I didn't hear him barking today. You know, like literally first name terms.
A regular.
Yeah, a regular for the VAT collectors. And I was just, I think my in-laws had said, you're stressed out. You know, they said to my wife, Michael's stressed out, and she was worried about me. So they said, there's some money, go and take a holiday to Salou and we went to Salou. It was raining, but we had a lovely holiday with two young kids. And I got a phone call when I was on that holiday, and it was Stefan King, the biggest bar, club, nightclub operator. His PA phoned me and said, would you be interested in meeting Stefan? And I got back from holiday, had a meeting with him.
You'd worked for G1 before as well?
I'd worked before, so I'd...
You were a known quantity, which helps.
Yeah, and I think one of the things, and we'll probably come back to this, is, you know, when you're working your way up through your career, I think it's always a terrible idea to leave on bad terms. Even if sometimes you feel like you're being, some people would say, exploited, mugged off, whatever. But I can remember when I went to leave, I had another job lined up. And they said to me, well, we want you to work 12 weeks notice. And it wasn't in my contract, but that's what we're going to have to do. And I agreed to it. And I had to say to my new employer, I need another 3 months.
Hold on, wait for me.
And they did. And I worked those 12 weeks. And I think that went down very well. So that was that came back to serve me at a time when I needed
it. I think it's the mark of a man and a woman, how you leave somewhere.
Absolutely.
Very importantly. You hear a lot nowadays, and many guests I've had on the podcast have said things like, oh, burn the boats when you go out to be an entrepreneur, et cetera, et cetera. But when you're still in that employment world, there's a massive benefit to leaving on good terms, because you never know who might buy who might come back round. And this opportunity came up because you showed respect on the way out.
Absolutely. So I would always say that to people, never leave on bad terms, even if it feels like, you know, they're trying to squeeze that last bit out of you. Try and do everything you can. And it came back. And effectively, I had this interview with Stefan when he said, I'm comfortable with you keeping your own business and coming and help us relaunch the Corinthian, which was, you know, they were spending millions of it on it. It was going to have a casino in it. Help us out for a year. And I really needed that. And I ended up there for 3.5 years. But I got all my debts paid off. And I came out of that with two units. So I had Soho and Little Soho.
That's Jordan Hill, isn't it?
Jordan Hill, which now actually... Long story short, I've signed that over to my sister-in-law. She ended up running it. And, you know, I was the owner, but I was never there. And she was doing everything. So we came to a wee deal during lockdown. She took it all over. And it's now twice as busy as when I had it. So if anyone thinks I've got the Midas touch, you know, that place is was doomed doubly.
Yeah, it's really popular. Really popular.
Really popular. She extended the kitchen. The interior got a woman's touch. And it's just beautiful what she's done with the place and doing really well.
During that period where you're working at the Corinthian, getting it ready, launching it, managing those early days, and you're working within Soho, what's the time split like? How do you manage to find time to do both?
Yeah, it was horrendous. I went into that with, whenever you do an opening, when you open a new bar, or you do an opening, or you extend your company by opening another bar, right, or restaurant, there's this period of time of 6 months, I would say, which is supremely intense. And I would also say that's if you're taking on a big role. So if you take over a big place like the Corinthian, this was the Corinthian opening. So we had a good 8 months of absolute carnage, exceptionally busy. I didn't have a day off in those 8 months. And I genuinely mean that. And when I say that, some days I might only pop in for a couple of hours, but I had to do something or I was on the phone or whatever. But we got that place up and running. I was really fortunate that there was a guy that I was working with who's now has remained one of my closest friends, a guy called Rodolphe. He'd been running that building for years and he was still there. So thanks to him, I was able to do it. My brother actually came in to help run Soho, which was great. But I mean, you know, some days I was coming in and helping in Soho. I'll give you an example, coming in, busy lunch, help them out at lunch. And then by 9, 10 o'clock comes where you're having the kind of normally having a wind down. I was going over to the Corinthian and working there till 2, 3, 4 in the morning. And it was just really, really long days like that and doing everything you could. But I could see that debt going down. I could see there was purpose. I never wanted to go back to work full time. And this was a unique opportunity I felt I had. So I wasn't going to blow it. So I just kept working.
One of the phrases that comes up quite a lot with guests is when you have your why, you can bear anyhow.
Yes.
And as long as there's light at the end of the tunnel, so that particular debt figure, I think you said 120K, as you see that whittle down, you do know when it gets to zero that you will be free and you will be able to put your all into these two businesses, or, well, one site at that point in time that you care so much about. So there is an element of the carrots there to keep going, whereas if it's just an endless pursuit and there's no end in sight, I think it's much more difficult.
Yeah, but you also have to recognise your own influence and ability to get to that light at the end of the tunnel. Now, one of the things in hospitality is you never quite get to the end of the tunnel in the sense that everything just runs fine, nothing breaks down, no staff ever leave, you're constantly busy, there's never a quiet day. You never get to that. But I'll give you an example. I've got a great manager just now in Edinburgh, a guy called Matteo, and we've just opened up a place there in Hanover Street. And in this week, we've had the sound system break down, the fire alarm go off during dinner service, so the whole building had to be evacuated. We've had a gas issue, which meant that in order to stay open, we've had to have gas fryers taken out and electric ones put in the space of like one day, all this going on. So he's done an intense amount of work. But he's done that, and I always say to them, look, you're going to get these periods of time, but your key is to build your team around you so that this is temporary. They see you doing it, and then you'll eventually have team members that will do that for you. You know, you're the guy just now. Build a team under you that can...
And your team members are much more likely to follow you down that path if they've seen you walk the walk as well. There's a case of... So, for example, many restaurateurs, maybe some listening to this, will be happy to take advice from you because you've been in the trenches, so to speak, and you've walked the walk, whereas you do get a lot of online intellectuals that we'll maybe get on to talking about in terms of some social media who are telling restaurateurs and people in hospitality how to run their businesses when they've never worked a day in their life in that sector. Yeah. And it's really difficult for people to relate to that and take that advice seriously. And that's why we get to this position where you've been able to build these good teams because there's a level of respect from what you've done prior.
Yeah. Restaurants are so volatile. So you have to have, you know, you have to obviously look at any working week, everyone with every role, within every role, you know, make sure that that restaurant runs according to plan. But what happens when the plan goes AWOL, when it goes tits up?
Yeah.
You like to swear on this?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. When it goes tits up. And, you know, someone has to step up. So if you lead by example, then others will do it at other times. I mean, it's going back to working in the pub days. Another lesson I learned off of Frank, which I teach to my managers, is if you're ever in a situation, someone's been sick in the toilet. And I said to Frank, I'm not doing that. I'm not cleaning up sink. And he went, oh, really? He went and did it himself. And he went, next time you do it. It's a nice metaphor, isn't it?
Yeah.
But that's literally what I'll do. I say to all my managers, make sure all your staff are aware that you have to clean, that you've cleaned up sink at least once. Just make sure everyone knows about it, or unblock a toilet, or do whatever.
I've heard you say before that one of the first entrepreneurial books that you read was The Millionaire Upgrade.
That's a great book, yeah.
What did you learn from that?
Do you know, the thing I learned from that, I that was actually, I mentioned that on a podcast that did at Go Radio, an interview at Go Radio with Willie Hawkey and Tom Hunter.
To Tom Hunter, I really enjoyed that.
And I went back and looked at that book and seen the foreword. I'd forgotten about this. That book's based on Tom Hunter.
So he was too modest to mention that.
Modest to mention that, right? So I felt like an idiot. I went, oh my God. I went back and I revisited that book. But what that book, the main takeaway I took from that, there's a chapter about what makes an entrepreneur know that they're an entrepreneur and that they really want to do it. And the book is about this guy that gets upgraded by default on a flight and ends up sitting next to the guy based on Tom Hunter. So Tom Hunter. And the guy teaches him all these lessons. And, you know, so Tom Hunter's story is that he was actually, and it's funny because I've spoken to Tom about this before, he was passionate about trainers. And he started selling trainers. And he says, honestly, a big part of my key success was the fact that I started selling trainers and tracksuits at a point when everyone was buying trainers and tracksuits. And but there was a point in it when it was saying, when you, and this is while I was working for other people, I read this, whenever you have that thing where you're got something you love and you've got that vision of where you want to be and whatever it is you want to do, there's something inside you that burns so hard that you just think to yourself, I have to do this. And if you don't, you're going to regret it for the rest of your life. But it's when that you get to that nexus of what you're passionate about and you want to achieve and how you think you need to get there. And when you get that, those three things together, that's what, and that's the thing I really took from that book. So I came back and I'd read that and I was like, oh my God, I need to work for myself. And that was when I was working for this company that, as you say, was a big PLC. And another chapter on it was, you need to work for someone who's done what you want to do. And I started thinking of all these entrepreneurs who'd started off with maybe one place and built it up. And I thought, I've never worked for, who's done that? James Mortimer.
Of course, Lynette Leisure.
And I'd bumped into him, a couple of months before and just ended up chatting to him about business. I had a friend that worked with him and all that kind of stuff. And we just had a chat and we met in a bar, a restaurant it was actually. And I thought, I wonder if I would still work for him. And it's like, you know, I don't know if manifestation exists, but he ended up offering me a job to go and run 29 and 1UP.
Which is now Kong,
that building. So it was, you know, that was another chapter. I thought, right.
It's interesting, there is a joining point between going out and doing Soho and leaving Tiger, and it is working for somebody who is built from the ground up.
Well, I think that what happened there was in 29, there was, it's a shame it's disbanded now, but there was a group called the Entrepreneurial Exchange, and they used to do a lot of their meetings and presentations and seminars at 29. So I was getting, you know, I was just making sure I would work them and setting up the room, and I was standing up the back and
free ticket
effectively. And there were great talks from Charan Gill, Chris Gorman, Sir Tom Hunter, Jim McCall, Willie Hawkey. And I'd be able to soak this up, but I'd also be able to speak to them. These guys were coming in for dinner all the time, and I just got to speak to all these entrepreneurs and people that had done it themselves. So it was a huge learning curve. Even when I went back, you know, struggling with my own business, and I went back to run the Corinthian, I was then working at another level where I was working, liaising with designers and builders, which wasn't something I'd done as much before. Because when I joined James, the building was done, the design was decided, and he was very on the design himself and working closely with designer. But I got to work with a guy called Jim Hamilton.
Okay.
Who's a world-renowned designer now. He's in Chicago and all over the world. Absolute genius. And another guy called Jim McMillan that does the building side of thing. His son now does my shop fits.
Brilliant.
So things like that, you know, your development's never finished when you're working, you know?
And you're constantly adding lessons from all these different individuals that you surround yourself with.
Lessons, and not to be, you know, I would always manage costs, but let's face it, you're playing with someone else's money. You know, when you go out in business yourself, you're having to
different feeling.
Yeah, you have to spend your own money, and if you're going to work with a designer, you're going to have to pay him or her. You know, whereas when you're working for other companies, you can pick the brains of all these people. You know,
absolutely. As you got to go full time with Soho, when did the idea for Bucks come about?
Bucks, I had this idea in my head where I love going to America. So I love New York, but I love the bars in places like Lower East Side, the kind of dive bars, the rock and roll bars, and places like Hell's Kitchen. And there's also places in Nashville called honky tonk bars. Now, at the time, you only had kind of style bars, and then you had pubs. And I thought, but there's this bit in between that's got this kind of, you know, vibrant atmosphere and vibe. I thought I had this thing in my head. You know, a bar like that would do really well. What kind of food would I do? Because everything needs to be food-led now. And everyone was doing smoked meats, burgers, gourmet burgers. And I thought, oh, that's not it.
There was a period in Glasgow where there was a new burger restaurant every week.
Burger restaurant and smoked meats and ribs and brisket and all that kind of stuff. No one doing it that well. It wasn't really a craze. I thought, but I need this thing. I need food that goes with the rock and roll and that kind of vibe and that kind of atmosphere. And I was in New York, and me and the wife got stuck there because there was a snowstorm, and we had to stay an extra few days. And I ate in this place, Peach's Hot House, and it had Nashville hot chicken. And I thought, that's it. Fried chicken, spicy. Glasgow loves spicy fried chicken, all that kind of thing. I thought, that fits in with this concept I've got in my head. And then I remember the Prince's fried chicken and Hattie B's and stuff in Nashville, that are fried chicken brands. But I still had a particular, I thought I have a particular vibe that I want this place to be. And that was it. Bucks was born. And then I was thinking, I wanted to call it a name. I think Mike's Bar or Bergie's Bar. Some people might call me Bergs, some people used to call me Bergie. And then I remembered there was one friend of mine, and I had this eccentric teacher with an accent called Mr. Sen, and he used to call me Buxon, right? And one of my mates used to call me Buck. When he called me, he'd go, Buck, Buxon, Buck. And I thought, it was a small nickname. I thought, Bucks Bar, that sounds a little bit like the noise a chicken makes. Bucks Bar, the logo was there, and the vibe was there, the food was there. We set about it. And then we went back to Nashville, and I went to Prince's Hot Chicken, where it was invented. And I said to this is an old trick I got from James Mortimer when he wanted to find out who the butcher was for a well-known steak restaurant. And I went to the back where the chef was having a cigarette out the back of the kitchen, because chefs are always out the back having fags or cans of Red Bull. That's just what they do. And I gave him $200, and I gave him a number, and I said, look, would you come and meet me and tell me how you make this chicken? I'll give you another $200. I'm staying in this hotel. And he came and met me, and he wrote down the recipe for the Nashville Hot Chicken, and ours is very similar to that bar one ingredient.
Brilliant.
And that's where it was
worth invented. The $400 as well, a bit.
It was, absolutely. Because any time I go,
because what you've created is very unique here. Like, it's very different to the other offerings. And as you say, you identified that there was plenty of burgers, there's plenty of smoked meats. You had this particular vision for how it was going to be in terms of a rock and roll bar. And I think if people that aren't from Glasgow want to understand what Bucks is like, everyone goes there. All age groups, all demographics, because it is, it's lively, but it's not a nightclub, it's not overpowering.
Yeah, it's like good to, the way I look at it is, I think it's really important that, you've got to have something unique, but you've got to respect, well, what are the traditions that have worked? So if you create something that feels like a pub atmosphere, which we kind of do, and we've got rock and roll music, but it's good time rock and roll. So it goes as, the way I say it, goes as heavy as AC/DC. You know, Metallica is just pushing it a little. Maybe get one. You might hear Enter Sandman, but you won't hear anything. And it's as heavy as AC/DC, but then you think of Little Richard, Elvis. So if I'm talking to an old guy and he says, oh, what kind of stuff do you play? I'll go, oh, Little Richard, Elvis, ZZ Top. And he goes, I'll go there. I'm talking to someone a bit younger, I'll say, yeah, we do a bit of Greta Van Fleet. We do this. Oh, wow, that sounds great. You know?
You've got to tick those boxes, because as you say, unless you have a huge demographic that are in a niche, you need to have some sort of broad appeal.
Yeah, which was always something, entrepreneurs used to ask me this all the time. They'd go, what's your demographic for your venue? And then why do you want one demographic? I could never understand that with restaurants. I can't understand that. I can't understand why I can't have a table of goths next to a table of top lawyers, next to, a bunch of punks, next to whatever. Students next to wee guys that listen to Open Goal. I don't understand why they can't offer.
Got to take the box for all of them. Yeah,
that's what I think. Yeah.
What were the early days like at Bucks?
Horrendous, absolutely horrendous. So I ran out of money. So everything I wanted to do decor wise, I didn't have anything. I had a few pictures. I didn't have the light and finish. I didn't have any of the neons. And I thought, right, as long as the food can carry us through. Initially, the food, the chicken we did was all on the bone, and it was all free range. That actually proved unpopular, because free range chicken is tougher.
Okay.
And, we do good quality chicken, farm assured, all the rest of it. But we don't do free range anymore. And, the reputation didn't really take off in that sense. I can remember a really grim moment. My friends were coming up from Manchester, and they said, let's all go out. I said, where do you want to go? And they went, we want to come to your new place. And that whole night, I had a guy on doing music, and I had me, the wife, my two friends, the manageress's mum and her partner, and that was it, Saturday night. And I was actually went in one morning and I measured it up for pizza ovens, because I thought I'd be as well doing another Soho here, Soho and Miller Street and Soho and West Regent Street. And then something happened after a year, and it just started kicking in.
What do you think the big turning points were?
Well, we first and foremost, we kept tweaking the food until we got that right. And then gradually Soho went through a good period, and we gradually, you know, I managed to get one neon in the corner and then different lighting.
It fed
and
a bit the other more business. Yeah. The cash flow from that was able to refurb Bucks the way you wanted it.
Absolutely. And that happened. And then we got one great bit of accidental PR where Shania Twain randomly turned up. And it was the weirdest experience. Because it was funny because we weren't that busy at this point, but I can remember I phoned the manager, Simone, and how's everything tonight? She said, yep, fine, nothing to note, right, put the phone down. And then a journalist called Bev Lyons phoned me 2 seconds later. Shania Twain's in your restaurant right now. I said, no, she's not. I just spoke to the manager. She went, swear to God, Shania Twain's in your restaurant. She just tweeted a picture. So I phoned back up and I went, Simone, that's going to sound mental. Is Shania Twain sitting in the restaurant? She went, oh my God, she is. So the funny thing about Shania Twain, she's known for country singing. She's actually a vegan.
Oh, wow.
So she's actually a vegan and she was in for a glass of wine and her husband had a vegetarian dish and she left and she posted a picture. But the whole connection with a famous country singer being in kind of, oh, she knows what she's talking about. That gave us a wee boost. And it kind of, but by that point, we'd got the food right. People were going crazy for this food. So it was just a matter of getting people to try it. We'd had people that had been before and hadn't really enjoyed it and they were coming back and it just took off from there.
I've heard you say before that Tam Cowan's review of Soho was a big turning point.
Yeah.
And in the same way, the credibility lended to your restaurant by a superstar like Shania Twain, who has elements of the rock and roll, like lifestyle, pop lifestyle.
Yeah, yeah. I think that the thing that I always say is, I was having this conversation recently, where with a restaurant, it's incredible how you can be £2,000 or £3,000 from oblivion. Now people say, what do you mean by that? And I'm saying literally, you can be in a situation where your bank balance is teetering around zero. So your suppliers call you on a Thursday. They say, sorry, you have to pay your staff on a Thursday, right? So you have to pay them on a Thursday, you've got no money. Then on the Friday, your suppliers say, if you don't pay this bill, we're not delivering on a Saturday. And you get a couple of grand in that day at lunchtime and you pay them. Your delivery comes in on the Saturday. So it gets to this point where then you get to Monday and it all happens all over again. You get another supplier hawking you. But it gets to this point where if you're short £2,000 or £3,000, your staff don't get paid. They're not going to turn up. People are going to stop turning up. Your suppliers aren't going to deliver. So you can't provide. You're having to tell your customers all the time, I've not got this X, Y, and Z on the menu. So see anything you can get like that in the early days when you're just above water, a good review or a little bit of PR or something that bites on social media, that can save you. And you've got to keep on that treadmill.
Once momentum starts, keep running downhill.
Absolutely. You've got to do it. But you can't just think, you know, that's us had a good review. You need to have the next thing and the next thing and the next thing, you know?
Yeah, and I think if you look at your socials now, that's something that Bucks really stands out with. Like, you've collabed with Open Gold and sponsorships there to reach that demographic. You mentioned Shania Twain. You've had, like, Billie Eilish in as well. Like, and all these things, you guys really make the most of that exposure, as you rightfully should.
Yeah, I mean, Billie Eilish thing, I've got a big reveal for you here. So, Billie Eilish is a strict vegan, right?
Stricter than Shania Twain.
Yes. This is a bit of opportunism. This is an example of opportunism, PR opportunism, right? I'm going to admit this publicly. So she's a strict vegan. So she bans her road crew from eating meat when she's on tour. And her road crew were in, and they were Australian guys, and they were saying to the manager, they were just in for a drink, a few pints, and they were saying to the manager, oh my God, that chicken smells so amazing. I wish we could get this. We've been made to eat vegan food and blah, 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 blah. She said, I'll tell you what, I'll send you a big order tonight if you phone me. She gave them a card. So that night they said, can you deliver this for after they've set up the concert at like 10, 11 o'clock at night? And there was loads of them. So they had these huge bags of takeaways. And I said, take a picture of that and say it's going to Billie Eilish and her crew. Because there were vegan products in there. So I didn't know if she was eating them or not. I thought, bet that vegan burger's for Billie Eilish. We sent it out and went viral and all over the press. And they all picked it up. And it was all over the newspapers the next morning. Next day, Billie Eilish's manager phones up, get that down now.
It already done its job, though.
It had done its job. But, you know, these guys got their chicken. She was angry with them. But, you know, I'm not slating her. You know, my boys set up concerts at the Hydro as a job, and my kids, and they met her and said she was lovely.
But yeah, you've got to take advantage of that, and it adds credibility, yeah. Adds reach. You probably gained an extra few thousand followers, however many, because I think Bucks is on like 65,000 on Instagram. Yeah, and that, yeah. Some people look at these things as like vanity metrics.
Yeah.
Like, oh, our Instagram grew by however much. But it does add credibility. If I'm going to a new city and I'm looking on the geotag for where I might want to go for food in Manchester or London or wherever else as well, and I go onto a page and it's got a good following and it's got fresh content of all its meals, it's got like people tagging it and stuff like that, you're like, okay, this is a credible spot that I want to go to. And yeah. I think, based on how the tactics you're employing, Michael, I think it's an underrated aspect of nowadays. Yeah,
one of the things that we've been really... I would always recommend Instagram or Facebook advertising as a way of promoting your business. But one of the things we do is we make it targeted. So you can target their interests and do it within a radius. And we don't really put that radius outside of Glasgow or now Edinburgh. So when we boost an advert, and we don't boost everything, but sometimes you can, if you it's a bit of a mystery sometimes.
You hit the algorithm and it goes.
You can post a burger picture one day and you get 500 likes, post it another, you get 40, and you know, you just don't know. But I would recommend that, yeah. But yeah, it's crucial. Instagram's massive.
What do you think are the other drivers behind Buck's success?
Well, the first thing was word of mouth, and that led to the whole Instagram growing, and then we were able to start growing that. So one of the things I really think helped us was in lockdown we kept going. So it was a point where, you know, we actually shut down just before the lockdown was called because a few of us got COVID, myself included. And we just said, right, we don't know how many of us have got this. We need to shut down. I think they're going to shut us down in a couple of days anyway. We'll shut now. And we did that.
There was a kind of middle ground at that point as well, where there was an element of like shaming people that were running their businesses absolutely as normal during that, but it wasn't an official lockdown and there was no funding off the back of that as well.
Nothing. So we did that, and so shut down for a few weeks, and I thought, do you know what? I'd like to do takeaway, but I don't want to look greedy and I don't want to make the staff feel like, because there was even before that, there was a couple of staff saying, oh, I don't feel safe and I don't, whatever. And I don't know if I'll do it. But then I had an ex-colleague said, I knew she was struggling, Yvonne, who's now our exec chef, is a fantastic chef. So she'd expressed that she wanted to work, and a couple of other staff had said, look, we're going stir crazy here. This is bad for our mental health. Can we do something? I'll do anything. I said, okay, let's do it. Buck down takeaway, just weekends. And that just, 700 people outside. I thought I was going to jail because, you know, large gatherings were illegal at that point. But we did that, 700 people outside, and then we had a system after that where it was like pre-ordered, etc. And we just kept going, and there was nothing else going on. So people were posting pictures of their Bucks bags and their Bucks takeaways, and our social media went through the roof. And then, you know, when they opened us up, shut us down, did that. Didn't matter what they did. I just said, that's it. See, now we're open. We're staying open. So we're not going to shut down. If they shut us down and tell us we can't have anyone inside, we'll keep doing takeaway. If they say no alcohol and we've got to shut at 5-6 o'clock at night, we'll just keep doing that. And I don't care. And it was just that momentum.
And people appreciated that during a time where it was difficult. You mentioned your staff were struggling. It was a period like no other, and I hope we never experience anything like regard.
It was a nonsense. And, you know, you can see with this COVID inquiry coming out right now today that...
Well, we're laughing at some of the news that just came out that Sturgeon deleted all our WhatsApps.
Deleting all the WhatsApps. And I believe there was a conversation had at one of the senior civil servants at a meeting with Jason Leach, who was the medical guy telling us what to do. He said, plausible deniability is my middle name. Delete all your WhatsApps. And Professor Leach responded to that, that's a nightly ritual for me. And these are people that were supposedly being meticulous in their analysis of this. But we knew that wasn't happening. There was the first time I kind of stood up to this.
Yeah, because you put your head above the parapet, I would say early versus... Early. Because nowadays, if you have conversations with people, a lot of people post-docs recognise how defiant they were. And I got a lot of heat on my Instagram. I had a few podcasts where I was being skeptical, not to the point of pushing things in a crazy regard, but I was talking about the gyms. I thought they should have been open from a health and wellness perspective, especially if they had the measures in which we deemed at that point to be suitable. But there was always, and I'm a big fan of the phrase, give an inch, they'll take a mile. And there were times you were giving an inch and, oh, we're shut for another 6 months in the gyms. And you're thinking, this is absolutely bonkers. So the restaurants were very similar, like dangling the carrot of opening soon or opening with this particular restriction. But like I say, you were somebody that quite early came out and spoke your mind on LinkedIn of all places.
Well, yeah, it was, I thought to myself, right, at the start, I thought, right, we need to shut down voluntarily. And as it went on, we opened up, Eat Out to Help Out came in, and I thought, right, this is all great. This is us back to normal. And then it started getting silly for me. And the line for me was when the UK government were coming out with their rules and Scotland were coming out with their rules. And Scotland started to put in all these extra ones. And the one that made me flip was the background music ban. Now, that was nonsense. Now, I'll tell you why that's nonsense. Was because there's scientific evidence that when you have a room full of people without music, they talk louder than they do if there is. So it's a strange thing that that's what it does. But they've got science that proves this. And there was actually a scientist that tried to get in touch with the government and send them it. Now, they were saying that speaking loudly spread the virus. They were doing it on the basis that if you were to contest this, well, you know, if one person dies from this, it's a small thing, you're just turning the music off. But we've sent them evidence, and there was then experiments conducted in my bar and a number of other places, which was then submitted to the Scottish government, and it took them 2 or 3 months. And when we were actually saying, look, this is making people talk louder, you're actually, if you believe that talking loud spreads viruses, then you're actually putting people at danger. And rather than go back on that and look politically weak, they kept it going till Nicola Sturgeon stood up and went, we've engaged with everyone, we've now decided that. And I thought, this
is... It was an incredible period for posturing. And I remember the reaction to that initial, those early posts where you were putting your head above the parapet. How did you handle that?
Well, I can remember I put one, and it was one post where I put, is this going too far, the background music ban? It was a picture of Nicola Sturgeon. And a screen grab of a headline in the trade press, Sturgeon's considering banning music. I said, is this going too far? Now, well over half of people are saying, no, it's not. There's more important things than your profits. There's more important things than this. There's more important things than that. And we got this onslaught. And I can remember my area manager, GM, and my head of ops now is Ashley. And they messaged me. I was on a group with them and saying, Michael, you need to... People are getting so angry with us. This could kill the business. I was like, no. I can't. I'm sorry. I think this is wild. And long story short, I mean, I then kept on about a number of things. And I just kept... Anytime something ridiculous was said or done, I spoke out. And you saw, you know, if you like, you know, the kind of for was here and the against was here. And then you started to see this shift. And bear in mind, these aren't my friends. This is an open account. Anyone can see it. And you could see the against just shrinking and shrinking. And, you know, I think it's taken us a path today when people are now looking at it and going like, do you know what? We were led down the wrong path. Things were done to the extreme. Politics did get in the way. And it has caused a tremendous amount of damage.
Well, I talk often about a cost of lockdown crisis, not a cost of living crisis. And initially when I said that, even like mid-2022, people viewed that as like a really unfair thing to say. Mm. But I think that the momentum has shifted to the other direction, where as we get further away from the time, people are thinking, oh, I can't believe we did these things. I can't believe we crippled this industry and this industry for the relative measures that went in place that had an impact.
Yeah, I mean, I don't care if you've got a business that is got 5 employees or a business that's got 500 employees. If anyone had ever said to you that over the next couple of years, I'm going to shut down my company for the majority of this 2 years and take out a loan to pay everyone 60% of their wages, I'm going to have no sales, I'm going to crush revenue, and I'm going to just let debt build up for my rent, maybe take out some bounce back loans, do all this kind of stuff. How would that be a feasible way for any business to survive? And they were doing that to the entire country and thinking we're all going to be fine after it. So all we did was say, look, this is going to end up as a disaster. And now, you know, you've got politicians standing up and you've got the SNP saying they blame Westminster for that. They're calling it a cost of Westminster crisis. The Westminster calling it a cost of living crisis. Other people are blaming Brexit. Nothing is taking money out of our pockets more than shutting everything down and, you know, spending more money than any of us ever had. All the money I had in furlough, I couldn't afford to pay that back. I'd be out of business.
I know.
So someone does.
It's remarkable. And when we were getting organised for this, you mentioned you listened to my episode with Rob Dix, who wrote the Price of Money. And one of the things we talked about in that episode was we had this narrative of austerity from 2010 when the Cameron government came in as a coalition all the way through pretty much until 2020, when suddenly we turned on the money printing tap and we created all this cash with no labour on the other side of it. So I can pay, or you pay somebody in the restaurant an hourly rate based on the labour they produce and the services that come from that. So that money is tangible and it has something related to it. We created money for forced sit at home. Like, it absolutely insane when you consider the actual market dynamics that comes to. So nobody who was paying attention was surprised by what started to happen. But now we have a lot of people waking up to the reality of what that period was. And some of the voices that were maybe shouted down at the start, you can see the momentum has significantly shifted to understand where you were coming from. And it was coming from I think one of the reasons that you were able to turn around the majority of the crowd was that you played the ball, not the man.
Mm.
You weren't super critical of Sturgeon back then. Nowadays, you're much more vocal about some of how she postured, et cetera, et cetera. But you were very keen to pick apart the policies. And many of us who applied common sense in that period, who weren't perhaps maybe as scared by some of the media, were able to apply common sense and rationale.
Yeah.
But people were so frightened that they didn't look at things that they would normally have been critical of.
Well, that was it. So the amount of messages I got of saying, I agree with what you say, but I can't comment, you know, private messages because of the work I'm in, or because I deal with the government, or I do this or I do that, or, you know, I'd be in trouble with my company. So it kind of made me get a bit between my teeth and think, no, I need to keep speaking about this. And then, of course, it's led on to other things now. But one of the things you said there, so I think it's what's important is if you think a situation is just wrong, right, what someone's doing is completely wrong, you shouldn't be afraid to speak out about it. So, for instance, at the moment, I'm speaking out about low emission zones. Okay.
You stood up against the deposit return scheme as well.
Well, that was actually, there was a guy called Blair Bowman who brought a lot of attention to that. He's a whiskey consultant, and everyone was fine with the deposit return scheme initially. He'd looked into the detail and he started spreading awareness, and then all of us started going, actually, this is a shit show. It was going to be exceptionally complicated, exceptionally costly, and gradually more and more drinks producers started saying, no, this is going to be a nightmare. What people maybe don't realise, because it was well publicised that there was a review of it, you know, in terms of the internal trading laws, it wasn't viable. But it also wasn't viable under Scottish laws, what they were planning to do to grocers. So if you were a grocer, it was going to be, you know, not optional for you that you had to accept these bottles, and, you know, you were getting, you know, there was a 20p deposit and you were getting like a penny back, and you were having to organise it. And some guy, a grocer, he actually put it down in paper and he said, look, this is how much money we're going to lose. And in a Scottish court, it was deemed, yeah, actually, you can't do that. So it was a total disaster. But again, you know, if you're just going to say, you know, if you were saying with lockdown, oh, it's completely long, we should just let everyone die and we need to, you know, just open up and get the money in, you know, countries. We weren't saying that. We were saying, look, there's other ways of doing this, and these rules that you're putting in are going too far, you know.
And without a tangible return on it as well, and it sounds terrible when there are lives at stake, and that's one of the reasons it was so difficult to have the conversation, because people had such an emotive attachment to it, and people were called granny killers, or do you want to, protect the NHS? And NHS, something that everyone in the UK has an attachment to, because it's really important that we have free healthcare at the point of access, and everyone is like attached to that. So if you are deemed to be trying to hurt that or increase the strain on hospitals, and like let's clap for and support the nurses, all these things were used to try and shield you away from asking the important questions.
You know, we're getting that as well with the low emission zone. So for the low emission zone, which is killing business, we've now got data on this. So for instance, retail in the whole of Scotland was, figures from the Scottish Retail Consortium, was down 2.2% all over Scotland. Some places were up. Edinburgh was up about 6% retail sales. Glasgow was down 9.6%, the worst in the whole of Scotland. Okay, so it's affected Glasgow. It's got worst affected retail in the whole of the country. So we know it's doing its damage economically. But in terms of what you're doing, you know, there's always two things you get thrown in your face. Well, look, people are dying of COPD or whatever. Okay. The other thing is, you know, the environment. But you're not going to save the environment by getting this tiny little patch in the middle of Glasgow and encouraging people to drive elsewhere, or asking people that can't afford to get a new car and ordering them to upgrade, or they'll get fined. The reason I've done it in this small patch in the middle of the country is because they've recognised that's the bit where most people have to drive through, and that's where they can accumulate the most fines. I did a post today about, there's in Townhead, you've got, you know, in the low emission zone, you've got an area that's not got busy roads, it's got high-rise flats, it's got struggling young families, schools, play parks, football pitches, and you currently can't drive there at any time.
There's also a higher likelihood that the social demographic in that area will be more likely to be affected by maybe a vehicle that's older or less likely to be able to replace it as well. So it's a double tax on the poor.
Yeah.
And that's one of my biggest challenges with these high-floated ideas. And there's a gentleman I've interviewed before in the podcast called Rob Henderson, and he talks about luxury beliefs. And the elites have a lot of luxury beliefs that they're not impacted by, and kind of high-floated ideas like, we're going to save the planet by doing this, or we're going to stop anyone dying from COVID by doing this. And it's very much like a do as I say, not as I do side of things.
Absolutely.
Because you're not truly impacted by the pain that's going to be felt by this. The people who are maybe at the hard end of these policies feel it the most keenly, but they have the least say at the ballot box or in the economy because of their social position.
Yeah.
And that is something that I think is really terrible, because you're like, they're like punching down the way, but almost telling you it's good for you. And I find that really distasteful.
Yeah, it's horrendous. And I mean, for instance, you know, you're allowed an older petrol car than you are. Diesel's apparently enemy, right?
Well, do you remember when diesel was meant to be good for you?
You pay less road tax. The government have been encouraging you to get diesel for years. We're encouraging you to get diesel for years by charging you less road tax. So all these old cars that you were encouraged to get are now, it's nonsense. I'm sorry, it is. And I know some people will be going, oh, come on, the environment, Michael, and this and that. No, the way they've done it is completely wrong. I actually got asked onto the Sunday show with Martin Geisler, and they had me on with an environmentalist. She's called Laura, and she's on Twitter as Zero Waste Laura. And I think they got us on to bounce off each other. And she sat down and went, no, this is completely the wrong way to do it. You can't go fining people that can't, or taxi drivers that are relying on the car for their living.
London's a warning sign for that, and I know you've been critical of the Scottish Government, and I certainly would be as well, but how London is administrated with a ULZ is frightening, and you do not want that here. And the phrase I used earlier, give an inch, take a mile, because this will expand to other areas if there's not pushback. And I think Perth managed to say no to it, which was one of the first cities that were towns that rejected it.
It's a funny thing because, you know, how's this going to end? Okay, so we tried the judicial review. There's an appeal for that in March. And it's more based around the fact that they just decided, and this was a Scottish Government decision, this wasn't a Glasgow City Council decision. So there were two sides to the case. One was saying, you know, you had no right to do this to this business. You know, William Payton's garage, which is within the LEZ. The reason his judicial review failed is because they had a modelling report from 2017 that said if you don't do this, emissions are going to go out of control, which hasn't happened.
That should ring alarm bells for anyone that saw the early forecasts for what was going to happen with C19. In 2020, we were forecasting 10 to 15% of the population to be hospitalised. Yep. Now, the pandemic absolutely was tragic in many shapes and forms, but actually many of us are thankful that it wasn't anywhere near as serious in terms of the disease for the majority of people that were exposed to it.
Yeah.
And in the same way with emissions and some of the forecasts around the climate, many of these things have not come to fruition.
Yes.
And we've gone on worst case scenario.
So we have this strange, we're in this strange place right now, and it's not just a Scottish issue, where under the auspices of public health forecasts, you're now able to push through laws that will involve people getting fined, restricting people's rights, etc. So that definitely needs to be looked at, I think. Because if you are doing something that's going to damage the economy, make people poorer, etc., and it's based on questionable forecasts, even though data can be provided that proves that that forecast was wrong, and we need to look at the way we're doing things. That's what we need to do.
It's really concerning. One of the things that I read during, I think it would be 2021, was about a thing called the Abilene Paradox. Mm-hmm. And it basically explains that a lot of the time there's a collective decide on one path and one route where almost nobody within the collective actually agrees on that, but we all assume that we do. So lockdowns were absolutely that. Nobody truly, really wanted lockdowns as they started to understand how it was working, but it was socially potentially unacceptable to do otherwise. And there was two things at play. One, the public and in general people are very afraid of death. And two, people are very afraid of social isolation and social ostracization. So you had two deadly factors that were combining, and the preferences of all individuals, if we actually had a more balanced conversation of the pros and cons and how it might look and what might actually happen, whereas we had this narrative of trust the science and what has genuinely been exposed in some of the WhatsApp messages as Project Fear at play, and the same tactics are being employed around the climate. And I would fall into a camp where I think there's an alarmism in the climate that's unmerited for a lot of people, and some of the largest mental health conditions within Gen Z are caused by fears and anxiety about the future of the planet. Wild when you consider like what the actual risk is to the individual.
Well, this is I think I'd add one last thing to that. That's really interesting. But there's a way of creating a righteous narrative. So I'll give you an example, which I think is a great metaphor for this whole situation. A customer of mine runs a school, and I was talking to them, and schools were getting shut down, and this customer of mine said, honestly, the damage we can be seeing getting done to kids is off the scale on so many levels, not just academically, but you know, you've got kids, abuse are clearly happening, kids with alcoholic parents, isolation, mental health, horrendous stuff, right? And because the righteous narrative was all around, we can't have these teachers dying, you had the majority of the teachers that wanted to get back and up and running, but the small minority was saying, I'm sorry, we're not going to do this. And then you had Nicola Sturgeon standing up going, I will not take any decisions where I think children may be harmed. And it was all, you know, by COVID, not by anything else. And it was that righteous narrative. If you can create that, then like you say, that situation described.
One of the worst things that I think's happened in the last 10, 15 years has been the reward for people being seen to do good without actually doing good. So virtue signaling would be a term that's used. And people gesticulating that they are a person of virtue and moral, but when you look at their actions underneath the surface or what the longer term lead times of their decisions are, that's when you actually see the real case. And Warren Buffett has a quote, and I've got a lot of different finance podcasts over the years, but this one, it actually stands true for a lot of things. It's only when the tide goes out that you realise who was swimming naked. And if we look at the reflection of the lockdown period, the COVID inquiry, and again, I think some of the questions they're asking are off the mark anyway in terms of what they should actually be looking for, you see that a lot of people during that period who were on their high horse and were gesticulating down at the populace were certainly not behaving in a moral and righteous way if you were to consider their actions. And that is something that I think will come to bear when we look at the climate situation too.
Absolutely. I agree with that as well.
One of the things that I think we definitely agree on, and I want to understand more about, is the political nature in Scotland is actually a little bit harsher on business, in particular hospitality, than it is down south. And I'm hypercritical of the UK government as well. But we are in an environment where it's high tax up here. And you had a conversation with John Mason from the SNP.
Yeah.
Again, fair play for him to doing that, but and sitting down with you. But I certainly think there were elements that you largely disagreed on. And you found that 51% of GDP is paid in tax in Scotland versus 38% in the rest of the UK.
Yeah.
Now, that's not a good environment for businesses like Bucks to expand, but also others to come in your slipstream and in your wake.
Absolutely. I mean, it was interesting, that conversation with John. So when I said that to him, he said, I wasn't aware of that, which I've now confronted him by email, by the way. So I'd sent him the figures and he wasn't even aware of that. And he said things to me like, well, France is, you know, far higher tax than UK. And then he mentioned the 51%. France is actually, for hospitality, they value the industry. It gets taxed less there. It's 11%. We're 20. So we're trying to push for something around the 12% mark. So still more than France.
Also, if you consider an independent Scotland, it would need hospitality, alcohol industry like whiskey, both of which have been hit very, very hard by this government, to be a fundamental backbone of the economy.
Look, what does an affluent culture look like? What does it look like? Let's envision anywhere, right? Okay, so let's say you hear that Denmark's a wonderful place, or Sweden, or you know Los Angeles, I don't care, wherever it is, Hollywood, I don't care. Let's think what that looks like. The roads look good, don't they? You know, the streets look clean, the bars are busy, and the restaurants are busy, there aren't empty units. You know, we are in complete decline right now, where there's empty units, the bars and the restaurants are quiet. You know, we have the most beautiful countryside here. We have wonderful product called whiskey. We have so much produce, so much going for us. But we also have our cities. What's going to attract people to cities? Okay, great. We've got wonderful galleries. Where are you going to eat after? Where are you going to stay? If you're staying in a beautiful hotel, you're going to go to a bar, you're going to go to a restaurant. You want as many of them as possible. You know, no one goes to... Okay, Berlin's got some sites, but everyone goes there for bars and nightclubs, everyone that I know. They've got a great scene. And, you know, it's just, you could say the same for Dublin, you know, and things like that.
Hospitality matters.
Hospitality really matters. And it really matters as well, like, you know, one of the things that I probably agree with the Scottish government on is, you know, anyone in our industry is pretty pro-immigration. Purely because, you know, it's when the Polish people were allowed into the UK to work, it was like a godsend. You had all these wonderful people,
hard-working, diligent. You're completely correct. Brexit, in that regard, disastrous.
You know, yeah, absolutely. So that was it. So, you know, I don't care if they're coming from Ukraine or whatever. Let's give these people a chance to work. But. You know, they're sort of encouraging that without sort of paving the way for where these people are going to work, how they're going to live. Got a great story, actually. We had a few, when there was a situation in Syria, we ended up with a couple of Syrian guys working in the kitchen. These guys are so tough, Colin, honestly. Like, I can just remember, you know, they're in the kitchen, summer, boiling hot kitchen, it's Ramadan, they're working away, 10-hour shifts, not even allowed water. Unbelievable. But one of the guys, Allah, who arrived, couldn't even speak English. And I can remember talking to him, this most wonderful country, they paid for my English lessons, they put me in a home, I've got my family over, blah, blah, blah. He got into college, he learnt the language, got his cooking diploma, and then he set up his own restaurant on Pitt Street, right? So we set this up on Pitt Street. He's open a couple of weeks, things are going great. And then roadworks happen on Pitt Street and he gets a rest and recuperation steel cabin dumped right in front of his shop, in front of his restaurant, without any notification, when there's an empty schoolyard 100 yards down the street. Now, that R&R facility, I know the guy that owns the barbers across the road, and he said to me, you know, I've never seen anyone use that. So he gets this, tries to contact the council, has no luck. His sales dropped 80%. He went in the newspapers, sales dropped 80%, and he ended up losing his business and all the savings he'd put into it. And he said to me, I don't understand why when I was here, and it's okay if I'm getting handouts and I'm getting this and I'm getting that, when I actually want to make something of myself, I get treated like a second-class citizen. What's wrong with Scotland? I thought, what a fascinating insight. A guy that's come here from Syria for a new life, and he's finding himself in this situation. And I thought, that says a lot about how business and entrepreneurs, you know, employees quite rightfully have a lot of rights. What about the rights of these people that are...
You mentioned Tom Hunter earlier. He speaks so passionately about the ingenuity of Scottish people, and of course people coming into our culture will be encouraged to be ingenuitive as well, but we are stifling that with red tape, bureaucracy, all these different schemes that are fundamentally anti-business. And one of your posts that I wrote down before I came in today was some of the words like growth, profit and earnings have been termed as dirty words, particularly by the S&P Green administration, because of their ideological standpoint. It's almost like frowned upon. So this chap, building this restaurant and wanting to grow and make some profit, reinvest it, maybe get a second unit. That's not at the moment encouraged within the culture. And that's a terrible indictment on where we want to go.
You know, I was talking to, I actually had a meeting with a member of a woman called Susan Young, who runs Dram Magazine. She's very well connected in hospitality. She's great insight as to what's going on all over the place. And we had this meeting. And she and I have disagreed on things before. Like, she was a bit more pro-lockdown than me. I was like, oh, you know, but she was the other way. And we're now agreeing on this. Growth has to stop being a dirty word. Now, the same way that we hear these, you know, if you were to get a wood-burning business in Glasgow and say, well, this is going to set back the net zero objective. If you're going to encourage, you know, whatever, we need to make it that we have a growth objective that's as crucial as the net zero objective. Let's do it sustainably, however you want to do it. But we need to get a conversation where the government have got to admit things need to grow back, not grow beyond what they were. Let's focus on growing back. Let's get as many people back into employment and jobs, get people earning what they need to survive, get more people coming to Glasgow to visit. Let's grow back.
These all sound like positive initiatives to me, but for that language to be deemed like, oh, capitalist, or Michael, you're being a Tory, that's a slur up here.
And
don't get me wrong, I don't associate with the modern Conservative Party particularly well. I don't think they represent me. But those terms are like are beaten down, and I find that tragic, because the way that capitalism is designed, it's got its flaws, no doubt about it. We can talk about crony capitalism during C19 with some of the contracts, etc. But a rising tide raises all ships, and we need to push up the way and try and bring the general standard back up to where it should be.
That's the way I look at it. If we're getting more retail around, we're getting more tourism, we're boosting retail and tourism, hospitality will come up with it. Likewise, if you're pushing more hotels and tourism and they've got no bars and restaurants to go, they won't come up as quickly.
Well, Virgin Hotel was here for a matter of months before
horrendous.
It failed.
Horrendous. And I mean, you know, there's a lot being said about that. My friend was the GM there.
Okay.
A big operation like that, which is to rejuvenate a crucial part of Glasgow. And it's a funny one, you know, when the shipyards are shutting down, or Grange, you know, there was a whole thing, you know, the was it Yusuf or was it Neil Gray or someone else? They were at Grangemouth, you know, refinery. We need to do a just transition. They're showing up. No one's showing up at any hotel or bar or restaurant to say this is actually damaging for the city. That Virgin Hotel's right on Clydeside. That area's been crying out for development. And that company were due to build another hotel next door. And the fact is, what that hotel was needing was a few booming few months when it opened up, and it didn't get it. And it's like, I'd say, okay, I spoke earlier about £2,000 to £3,000 from Oblivion. They're probably a couple of hundred grand from Oblivion, but they need to get that in 1 week. Do you know what I mean? They've clearly not had the festive season on the books that they needed, etc. What are the government doing to try and attract people to the city so that we can regenerate and we can do this and we can support all these things? And they're not doing anything. They're not selling. Anything you see in Scottish tourism that's commissioned by the Scottish government at the moment is based around hills and countryside. There's nothing to sell the city experience.
And those are great assets. I completely agree. But let's do both. Let's feed both. What kind of initiatives would you call for? You mentioned moving that 20% closer to 11, 12%. There are other things that you're hoping for?
Yeah, well, the one thing that I want to do, like, I have to repeat this, is there needs to be an agreement from all parties that we've got to have a grow back campaign, and anything that's done to damage it must be frowned upon in the same way that if I was to open a coal factory, that would be frowned upon because it would cancel the net zero objective, okay? Anything that goes against the growback needs to be looked at. So things like LEZ policies, digging up Sucky Hall Street, you know.
Rain gardens,
Sucky Hall Street, where you had trees and benches and it all looked fine. The pavings weren't actually knackered and now we're building a rain garden there and we've just ripped it all up and left it there during the festive season for all these businesses. That will affect the Grow Back campaign, you know. If a hotel's shutting down, what can we do to help it stay open? Maybe some rates relief, bars shutting down. That would affect the Grow Back campaign. So let's try and keep these bars open, these restaurants open. Let's look at rates relief. Let's do it so they can keep paying their taxes. And that's what I want to do. That's where the focus needs to be. But yeah, VAT needs to be looked at. Rates relief need parity with England. LEZs, nonsense like that, scrapped. Not reviewed, scrapped, okay? You know, if you're going to do something like that, you must first improve some kind of transport infrastructure. The other thing I would say for hospitality, we own the trains now, right? The government owns the trains. Let's look at some later services. Now, the government know how essential these late services are because when First Bus, who are the main bus operator in Glasgow, they said they were cutting back on the late services. The head of the Scottish Government, Humza Yousaf, Nicola Sturgeon, all these bigwigs wrote a letter to First Bus saying this is going to be a disaster if you do this. So they know there's a problem with our late night transport, but they've done nothing to support with the trains. I actually took another bus company, McGill's, to come in and put those services on. It's also interesting, the background of that is because First Bus weren't actually losing money on those routes. They just have a finite amount of buses and drivers, mainly because they've had to upgrade to electric, which costs $500,000 a pop. And they had to put those buses onto busier routes to be profitable.
And the infrastructure is still not ideally there for electric either.
It's not there. So what we need to do is look at the trains, maybe take some routes off, put others on, charge a bit more at night, trial it at least. So all these things can happen, but no.
If you're going to discourage cars coming into the city centre, and that's happening, like, for example, for my parking today to record with us, £8.20 or something like that.
Yeah.
Now, my train from Westerton Bears Den is £5.50 return or something like that as well. So neither of these are cheap options in terms of getting in and around the place.
Yeah, you're now more, if you park on West Regent Street where Bucks is, you're now cheaper, and you park for, say, you're doing a day's work, then you will be cheaper taking the ticket than paying
£30 ticket.
You take that because I think it's like 33 quid, 32.80 or something like that if you park there all day.
How wrong-headed is that? I just find that terrifying that we're facing.
Yeah, there's no joined up thinking, you know. I had a bar on Sucky Hall Street before, the Variety Bar. Okay. You know, it was all pedestrianised. There's actually pictures on the you know, when they were promoting the project, of seats outside the Variety Bar, and then they decided, they went, oh no, we're not going to have seats outside pubs because there's houses there. There's no, you know, continual joint up thinking of a vision where Glasgow's going to be better, and you can see it.
Absolutely. When I see people push back against you, and it's very few, on the LEZ rhetoric, I refer them to what happened in 2021 here when COP26 visited. Mm. And we had 30,000 delegates fly in from all over the world during a time when we were all being told to be careful and not socialise too much and have our jabs and wear our masks and whatever else was happening. During that period, if people were really clued into what was being talked about at that conference, they would understand that LEZ is the first and a stepping stone of a number of different measures, which would mean that private car ownership is heavily reduced, public transport is heavily encouraged, and that we are more zonized in terms of where and where we cannot go. So when I see people maybe thinking that you're overreacting to what's happening with LEZ, what they don't understand is this is the snowball at the top of the avalanche, or the first domino to fall. So if you don't push back now, we will find ourselves down a slippery slope that many people don't realise quite how far it's going to go. For example, we had a signed agreement where there was going to be no private car ownership in the UK by 2030, or a significant reduction at 80-90% or something like that. Many people aren't aware of that. So it's very important that we have voices that are forthright before we get to that.
Yeah, I mean, see, if I was going to do something like that, I'd make sure there was like the most sophisticated tram network, blooming, you know, scooter network, whatever the heck it takes. You would put some sort of infrastructure in place before you started that.
You speak really highly of Manchester. I know you spent some time down there. I'm down there with my corporate job quite often. We have a warehouse there. And the network there for the trams is so much better in terms of transport. Mm-hmm. So you can see why it's heavily pedestrianised, there's less cars. If it introduced an LEZ, which I strongly disagree with anyway, but if it did, you could see it wouldn't hurt to the same extent.
Well, there's an interesting perspective there, because Manchester has now said they're not going to do an LEZ. Now, my beef with Manchester is I lived there in the early 2000s, and I used to send people from Manchester to Glasgow, and they'd come out and go, Glasgow's amazing. Some of them preferred it for hospitality, nights out, bars. It was like this, and now Manchester's up here and we're down here. It's horrendous. So an interesting number for you. This is really, really interesting. So Manchester's now said we're not going to do an LEZ, because actually, if you want to save the environment, the way to do it is a fund, and during a cost of living crisis, is a funding-based approach, non-fining, where you're actually giving money to people to get cleaner cars on the roads. That's the way to do it, grants. So they've invested 86 and, sorry, also, you know, an improved transport infrastructure, public transport infrastructure. That's how you're going to do it. So they've invested 86 million to do that. Glasgow invested 2 million. See, all whenever you hear them talking about grants for taxis, 2 million was in the pot. 86 million in Manchester. Now, the first thing a politician will say is, well, where are we meant to get the 86 million from? That's supposed to help our NHS. It's an interesting number, 86 million, because it was exactly the same amount that was spunked up the wall for the deposit return scheme that never happened. So, you know, a bit of careful money management. And a bit, you know, that was one environmental measure that never even happened. And here we're short of 86 million to actually do something that would put cleaner cars on the road. We don't have the money. That's the elephant in the room. If they want to do these things, they need to manage our taxes a lot more carefully.
Yeah, agreed, Michael. I find it really challenging. One of the things that the occasional troll will say on your socials is that, oh, Bucks is growing and there's other businesses that are growing. They'll maybe name particular businesses that have done really well in Glasgow. Like you mentioned Kong, Wonder Bar. You can name particular restaurants. My friend owns Malaga Tapas. He's increased from one unit to three over the last 3 years. He's done fantastically well. Really, really proud of him. But that's in a vacuum, because that's not the wider picture if we look at the bigger picture. Yeah, yeah. So I find that really disingenuous when maybe people hold up success stories like yourself in a wider backdrop that's not successful.
Yeah, I mean, I've been in this industry now for, 30 years. I mean, it's horrendous. That's how long I've been in it. And it's taken this long to have six units. That's great. As you say, this one concept that's taken off. But why can't we have that opportunity for more young people to set up their own business, to work their way up in hospitality, to learn the industry? See, in order to do that, you know, I started in a family pub. Then I went to a big expanding London company. Then I went to, I also worked for G1, which were a hugely expanding company. So these bring opportunities where you can actually work up the ladder and get all this extra experience. You need to grow or you die. And that's not just for economic growth. It's for personal growth. People want to grow in their careers. They want to get better. They want to work their way up the ladder. They want to have a better living. They want to be able to retire. They want to be able to, you know, afford to go on holidays. There's nothing wrong with that. That's what we all need to focus on.
Aspiration is a positive trait.
It is. And without it, what are we? Look around the city. Do you want it to stay like this? Or do you want it to get better again? Let's at least get it back to where it was.
Yeah, completely agree, Michael. You mentioned you're up to six units, four in Glasgow, two in Edinburgh now.
Yep.
What's next for Bucks? What would the next 5 years have to look like for you to consider them a success?
Well, you know, first and foremost, keeping those, don't take your eye off the ball, keeping those six still going and profitable. But really, I mean, you know, I would like to see, for me, the biggest part of success is the people that work under you, trying to get them to a position where they've got a great life and a great career, your staff. So I would like, in the next 5 years, I would like to see 10 bucks. I would like to have a strong chain. I would like to be able to have some success down in England, looking at Newcastle, Liverpool, Manchester, like you mentioned, places like that. And I would like to have maybe 10 to 12 units in the next 5 years. So one a year for the next 5 years, I think we'll be happy with that. Anything less, we'll be disappointed. Anything more is wonderful.
Amazing, Michael. Well, I've thoroughly enjoyed today's conversation. I'm sure the listeners have as well. If they want to continue the conversation with you, where should they head towards?
Oh, jump on LinkedIn, Michael Bergson. That's the only social media I use. I stay away from Instagram. I stay away from Facebook these days. That's the only place.
Yeah, fantastic. And what's the handle for Bucks Bars on Instagram?
Bucks.bar. Check it out. And Thundercat Pub Diner. Look it up.
Wonderful. Well, thank you to you, Michael, and thank you to the listener. I'll be back to speak to you all again very, very soon.